This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from SUP China. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I am your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, and I saw a bunch of ants carrying around a potato chip this morning. It made me wish I had a bunch of friends and a really big potato chip. My co-host is John Pass, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and can't remember a single time when he forgot something. Cantonese, it's in the same family with Mandarin Chinese, but what is this language all about? In response to a listener question, John and I are going to tell you everything you wanted to know about Cantonese, but were afraid to ask. Guest interviews with Daniel Peng, who grew up speaking Cantonese at home, became a doctor, then quit his job to learn Chinese. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hey everybody, I am John Pazin. I am in China, in the city of Shanghai. How's it going?
All right, Johnny, we have got a review that we're going to read before we kick into our episode today. Our review comes from Roger. He says, love the podcast and the books. It's provided valuable insights about language learning. It's been enlightening to see that modern teaching recognizes the difference between a child who is a native learner and someone who is learning as a second language. Understanding that educators are recognizing this importance difference has been a real help in language learning. I also want to give a big thumbs up for the books. Great Expectations is the first Chinese book where I felt I was getting beyond reading for content and meaning, but beginning to appreciate the way an idea was expressed or the way a sentence was structured. Certainly did a great job capturing the essence of the original, which is not an easy book to read in English. All right, well, we appreciate that. And he also asked, hey, he wants some heritage learners to hear about their stories, and we have an interview today with a heritage learner with a little twist on it, too. So appreciate that, Roger, and we love hearing from you guys, so feel free to drop us an email. Roger did drop us an email, so you can do that. Find us at mannercompanion.com, or you can give us a review there on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Roger. And next up, we have a question from Patrick. And Patrick says, dear John and Jared, your podcast has really motivated me to learn Chinese, and I am so grateful for all the hard work you put in. My wife is from Hong Kong, but is fluent in both Mandarin and Cantonese. While Mandarin has been easier to learn, and I'm still very much a beginner, we would both like it if I could speak Cantonese. Her family mainly speaks Cantonese, and I would love to speak it with them, as well as have any kids we might have in the future being able to speak it too. So, do you know of any resources that would be helpful in this regard? Thinking of things like the Chinese Grammar Wiki, which is amazing. Thank you. Or any apps I can use to learn. Life is probably too busy for classes at the moment, though that might change in the future. Okay, so he's asking about resources for learning Cantonese. Okay, here we have a little bit of bad news. Neither I nor Jared are fluent in Cantonese. In fact, I don't think either of us have learned more than a few words. What about you, Jared?
You know a few words? Well, you're doing better than me. I don't really know any Cantonese. Oh, no. I do know how to say nine dragons.
Okay. Well.
Yeah, Kowloon. Kowloon, Jiulong.
Yeah, you got the Kowloon tones right there, huh? Thing.
Maybe. I don't know.
Cantonese tone, has sure. More tones than Mandarin. Fun. So we do want to answer your question. However, since we're not experts, what we're going to do today is we're going to set the stage for other Cantonese learners, people that are interested in it. And we're going to kind of kick that question down the road because we're hoping that our listeners can help and give us some recommendations and information and maybe even serve as a guest who learned Cantonese after having learned Mandarin, because I know those people exist.
But we're not going to let that stop us from talking about Cantonese today. Oh, no.
Oh, we're still going to talk.
Yeah, we're definitely going to do this. We're going to talk about everything you wanted to know about Cantonese, but were afraid to ask.
Well, maybe not everything. But anyway, we are going to talk about it. And we're going to start with this idea of dialects. And, you may have heard that Cantonese is a Chinese dialect. And that's kind of not really true because it's quite complicated. What do you know about this, Jared, from like a layman's perspective?
Okay, well, I think we'll preface this is that a common question that I've gotten from people when I tell them I speak Chinese, that they say, do you speak Mandarin or Cantonese? And so there's always this strong perception out there that Cantonese is like maybe like the official language, or like it's like one of the more popular languages per se, or in Chinese, but they're not even really sure about the differentiation. But I will say I do have a little bit of information on that, John, but you know more about this. But generally with Cantonese, there's about the estimates a little vary, but it's about 80 million native speakers of Cantonese. But it is not even the second largest, as you quote-unquote say, John, dialect, right, of languages that are spoken in Chinese. The Wu dialect, you know, has about 90 million speakers.
I'm living in the heartland of that.
Exactly. So that's in the Shanghai region, right?
Okay, so we're going to start out by talking about these dialects, but I want to refine that a little bit. But before I get into that, let me just say one thing. If you're an absolute beginner focusing on a standard course like the HSK with no linguistic curiosity and have no interest in history, then you might not like this podcast. But if you live in China, or you have lived in China, or you have plans to live in China, this is for you. Or if you have an interest in China's changing society over the past 100 years of modern history, this is for you. Or if you're at least intermediate and you just want a better understanding of the language, this is for you.
I just to put a finer point on it, this is about linguistics, which some people think is like about like learning to speak a language, but no. Linguistics is more about like learning about a language.
Okay, so let's briefly talk about what is a dialect, because some people might think, oh, a dialect, that's like British English and American English. Is that a dialect? Well, yes, they are dialects of English. And when you talk about dialects, you usually mean that they are mutually intelligible. So the Brits can understand the Americans, the Yanks can understand the British, right? Mutually intelligible. Now, when you start talking about Chinese and variations of Chinese, it gets a little more complicated, because for stuff like Mandarin and Cantonese, they're not mutually intelligible, like beyond like a few very basic things. In fact, I think it's fair to make the comparison between like Spanish and Italian, which are more mutually intelligible than Cantonese and Mandarin, and yet those are separate languages.
You know, there's a saying in Cantonese that refers to this, John. It says, translated, it says, the chicken and the duck trying to communicate with each other. So, you know, just because someone speaks Cantonese doesn't mean that they're going to be understand Mandarin and vice versa. They're about as intelligible as English versus Spanish, right?
Right, and it's a complex issue. I mean, it's not just an objective thing about can we talk to each other through some standard. It's actually about politics, too. So there's a famous saying by Max Weinreich. He says, a language is a dialect with an army and navy. So obviously issues of politics and power, they come into play. And definitely in the case of China, let me read this quote from Wikipedia real quick because it's totally relevant. National boundaries sometimes make the distinction between language and dialect an issue of political importance. A group speaking a separate language may be seen as having a greater claim to being a separate people and thus to be more deserving of its own independent state, while a group speaking a dialect may be seen as a subgroup, part of a bigger people, which must content itself with regional autonomy. All right, so I don't want to make any divisive claims here. But the point is, it's obvious that the Chinese government likes to say, you know, we all speak Zhongwen and we have different, but they don't use the term dialect. They use the term Fangyan, which is kind of like a special Chinese word, which is sometimes translated as topolect. So like, it's not so much an issue whether or not they're totally mutually intelligible or not. It's more like, you know, we're all Chinese, we use Chinese characters, we have this common history, so we all speak Zhongwen, and it's Fangyan, and it's all good.
Or, well, John, clear this up for us a little bit. I mean, you say topolect, and I have a cursory understanding of what that is, but maybe you could just kind of explain it so it's a little clearer to me and anyone else listening.
So there are these different regions of China, and they speak their own local, you know, Fangyan. You want to call it dialect, you want to call it language, it's all in there, but I'm just going to say Fangyan. And they have spoken that language for, you know, hundreds, thousands of years. And it's not until, like, right around the turn of the century, 1900, that Mandarin started crystallizing as the standard language of the whole country. And also, around 1920, 100 years ago, that people started using a standard written form of the language that was based on the spoken form and not classical Chinese. So it's kind of cool because this is all very new.
Absolutely. You know, and I think this is actually a great opportunity to maybe address there are some aspects of Cantonese. And maybe there are some misconceptions as well about this language. So, you know, one specifically is I talked about earlier is that, you know, a lot of times people will say, oh, you speak Chinese, you speak Cantonese or Mandarin. Well, one of the reasons that this comes about is that there's a perception that Cantonese is more or less overrepresented than it really is. Okay. So this really comes from basis in history that all throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, like the area of Hong Kong and Guangdong, it was the only Chinese province that was allowed to trade directly with foreigners. So like a lot of Westerners who decided to learn a language, if they wanted to engage in commerce with China, they learned Cantonese. And also, a lot of the diaspora, the early diaspora of, you know, people leaving China, came from the Guangdong region and Hong Kong region. So, for example, at least here in America, you know, there's, if anyone knows about the history, for example, like the Transcontinental Railroad, there were, especially coming from the West, those teams were largely Chinese people, but they came from that area and they spoke Cantonese. So there became a lot of the early, I guess, people, the settlers, if you will, that came out of China were Cantonese speakers. And it's kind of estimated not until maybe around the turn of the millennium, so around the year 2000, that there actually became more speakers of, you know, standard Mandarin, Putonghua, outside of China versus, you know, Cantonese speakers. So the Cantonese speakers, by large, were more than the standard Mandarin speakers outside of China. And if you go into a lot of areas, like in Chinatowns, at least here in America, and others, they're all over Europe and different areas, is that you will find quite a few people who will speak Cantonese because those people were the early, you know, people who left China.
Yeah, you do want to keep in mind, though, that it's not at all as simple as Mandarin versus Cantonese. So, you know, Cantonese has a lot of speakers, but if you look at China, there's all these groups of Fangyan, and if you go from, like, town to town within that group, then you're going to get little variations. And traditionally, with the exception of places like Beijing, which the standard dialect was based on, you'll find that a lot of people, they just grow up bilingual. When they talk to their families, they speak the local Fangyan. When they talk to their friends, they speak that. But then when they go to school, it's the standard national curriculum, and they're expected to speak Mandarin. So it's kind of funny. I've talked to Chinese friends who don't think of themselves as bilingual at all. But when they're speaking their local Fangyan, like, none of their Chinese friends around them can understand what they're saying because they're not from there.
That's a really good point. In case in point, one of our guest we had on the show, episode 43 with Eric Majerus, his in-laws come down from actually the Guangdong region down there, but they speak Taishanese. So, and like, they didn't really even speak, you know, standard Mandarin. But you will find a lot of cases of this, especially with the older generation.
Yeah, but this is something that you can't really avoid if you go to China. I mean, if you're in Beijing the whole time, it won't be as much of an issue, but especially along the eastern and southern coast of China, like, there are some very different Fangyan from Mandarin, and you will not understand anything when people are speaking in that Fangyan. And it's just a part of the experience of China. There's a lot of linguistic diversity here.
There's also another misunderstanding about Cantonese, which I think is interesting. This relates to, I guess, it's urban legend almost, you know, a misconception, a story that kind of goes around. And here's how the story goes about Cantonese, is that Cantonese almost became the official language in China. And it was sometime after the revolution in 1911. As a legend goes, that the father Sun Yat-sen and other founding members of New China, they voted to decide what language should be spoken, like the official language of China. And they said, well, Mandarin was a northern dialect spoken by Qing officials, and it was seen as the language of invaders. And so there was a vote. But in the end, Cantonese lost out by one vote to Putonghua. So maybe you've heard that story, that Cantonese almost became the official language of China, but it is false. It is just not true. In fact, there was actually a great response to this written by Mark Roswell. And John, you know Mark, right?
Dashan, yep.
Yeah, so Mark is legendary. He goes by Dashan. He's a popular entertainer in China. He's a amazing Chinese, but he pretty much, he talked about this saying, and there's a lot of responses you can find about this, but his was very good, and I'll just quote a little bit. He says, "At the risk of sounding arrogant, the story of Sun Yat-sen and the vote of 1911 is just nonsense. It's simply a myth that unfortunately continues to survive 100 years later. And Mandarin Chinese is the standard version of Chinese for deep-rooted cultural and historical reasons, not because of some accident of history." So really, it goes on, and the thing about this is that it's some of the things that kind of makes Cantonese speakers, you know, feel good, and we don't want to put that down. I mean, Cantonese is an amazing language. I mean, all languages are can be beautiful in their own respect. But it's saying that it was already the most prominent language, like standard Mandarin, Putonghua, was the most prominent language that was already being used in China. And it wasn't, and you couldn't even impose that based on just some sort of backroom dealing and voting. So that's just a little background on this story. And, you know, it's a little bit more nuanced and it's a little more complicated, and languages are complicated.
And Jared, I hope you're going to cite your sources on this information.
And there's a lot of sources. So the best thing I'll do is I'll link to, I think, Mark Roswell's response.
Oh, passing the buck.
It has all the...
Passing.
There you go.
All right, anyway.
He's got all the sources there, so you can check those.
All right. Well, what I'd like to do is take the topic back a little bit to how this might relate to a typical learner of Mandarin, whether or not you plan to learn Cantonese. And the fact is that when you go to China, there are a lot of Fangyan around you. And even if it's not Fangyan, there are like accent / dialectual differences. So for example, people speaking Mandarin in Beijing speak it in a slightly different way than when they speak in Shanghai. And, you know, the Beijingers will say they have a terrible accent in Shanghai, and, you know, Shanghaiers see it differently. But the point is that they pronounce some words differently. Sometimes the Shanghainese don't speak as standard. You know, you can't hear the NG. It sounds like an N. There's plenty of that going on. So it's useful to know that the local Fangyan is influencing the pronunciation of the people around you. And it's also kind of a choice that you have to make as a learner. And this is something that I faced when I was first learning Chinese in Hangzhou. So I was learning, you know, standard Chinese. I had my dictionary and people would pronounce things and it didn't really sound like it was an NG, or it didn't sound like a ZH. It sounded like a Z. And so I had to figure out, because, you know, I wasn't trained in this aspect of Mandarin, I had to figure out that that was their accent. They weren't pronouncing things the standard way. And then I faced this question, well, do I want to talk just like them and just imitate them as precisely as I can? Or do I really care about sounding more like, you know, a standard Mandarin speaker? And I chose the latter. I tried to be standard. When people pronounce things the non-standard way, I'd look it up in a dictionary and try to learn it right. That continued, you know, all through my studies, but I was aware of how the people around me were pronouncing it. And the funny thing is, sometimes they would tell me that I sound like I studied in Beijing, which is funny because no one in Beijing would ever say that. But the people in southern China, they kind of felt that way. So I have met some people, though, that, you know, learning Chinese, they don't care about being standard. You know, they're not pursuing a career in education, you know, teaching Chinese or anything like that. And they just want to get along better with, you know, their Chinese family or whatever. And if that's the case, well, then, you know, go for it. Speak the version of Mandarin that they speak, and maybe even learn their local Fangyan, because you want to get closer to them. That's your goal, right?
There's a great story about this from an interview that we did in episode 10 with John D'Andrea. Now, he learned Chinese, I think, back in the 70s, and when China opened up in the early 80s, he had an opportunity to go there to actually apply everything he'd been studying. And he got to go to the area of Lanzhou, which is it's in the central northern area of China. And he spent, I try to remember, maybe like a year there. And it says after he was there for a while, he then had some sort of trip to Beijing. And he said that on the train there, the stewardess were laughing at him because his Chinese got pretty decent at that stage, but he had a thick Lanzhou accent. And it was very different then than it is now. Obviously, the resources we have now are just vastly more. But aside from that he did previously, he didn't have access to like native speakers almost like at all. And so that was his only point of reference, was going to China and listening to these native speakers there in his area of Lanzhou. So they said he sounded like, you know, equivalent of like a country bumpkin, you know, like an uneducated guy. And so it took him a while, I think, trying to expose himself to maybe the more standard pronunciation and accent before, you know, he felt maybe a little more comfortable in other settings. But, it's really important. And I had this a little bit of this type of experience when I was learning Chinese in Shanghai. It was just a very small aspect of it, but learning to say the word for road and, you know, lu in standard Mandarin is it's lu. But I always heard taxi drivers say luo, right? Or I try to remember because I was like luo or something like that. So I would start to say lu like that, and I remember saying it one time, like, you sound like a Shanghainese guy saying that. I'm like, oh, well, that's how they say it here. And I learned the difference later on.
Yeah, another example from a learner perspective was I have a friend, Jason, who I worked with at Chinese Pod, and he was actually on one of our other episodes. And he lived in Shanghai for a while, and then he moved to Taiwan. So then I asked him later, like, so are you gonna switch accents? You gonna abandon the mainland Mandarin in favor of the Taiwanese Mandarin? And the answer was yes, he did. His wife is Taiwanese, and he sounds like a Taiwanese guy now when he speaks. But I also faced the same question, like when I first came to Shanghai, and you know I've been here a long time now. Should I learn Shanghainese? And my mentor at Chinese Pod, Ken Carroll, he spoke a little bit of Shanghainese, and I saw the way the Shanghainese would light up when they saw him speaking Shanghainese, and it was nice, and I could see that it was good for business, and forming relationships. But I don't know, for me personally, I always just would rather spend time working on my Mandarin and making it even better, because everyone speaks Mandarin. You're not going to make anyone think you're Shanghainese. And I like to kind of learn Shanghainese kind of like low-key, so I can kind of understand what people are saying and they don't know I can understand.
So let's take this back a little bit to, you know, a little bit of this original question here of like, you know, hey, how should I learn Cantonese? And we're not fully addressing that in this episode because we lack that depth of expertise for sure. But I think maybe, what we can talk a little bit more about here and specifically is about learning a specific dialect, and Cantonese could be one of those. And how to even like approach that, and, you know, what are some of the cases to do that? John, you hit on that one aspect of, you know, romance, love, right? You know, maybe you have a spouse and your wife is Shanghainese, right? And but also the ability to talk to family. And there's also the aspect of maybe some business. I will say this, John, is that in my experience in running my business there in Shanghai, there's sometimes, when I have an employee who's local Shanghainese and they are able to talk to some other, you know, official or bureaucrat, if you will, in Shanghainese, it opens doors, right? It sometimes can make things just go easier. There's a special connection that can happen. And so if you even learn to speak a little bit in the language, in the local dialect, it can sometimes help you. But you usually got to be living and trying to do something in that area where it maybe becomes more valuable in that respect.
Yeah, just one thing you need to know. If you do want to learn one of these fangyan, it's almost never possible to just use pinyin to write it. Like everyone thinks, oh, just use pinyin. Like it doesn't work for Cantonese, doesn't work for Shanghainese. Like it's just very different. It's more different than you might think. And the tones are totally different. So it's quite a bit of work, but there are definitely good reasons to do it, especially if you have a good ear and you don't need to take notes and you just want to listen and repeat, then it's definitely possible.
The other aspect about this too is that in order to really like gain access in any learning materials to a lot of these dialects, you need to first learn standard Mandarin, right? And this isn't always the case. For example, with Cantonese, there are some language learning resources for native English speakers, but for Mandarin speakers, the resources are 10 times. I've even heard some people saying online that, hey, there's like 100 times more, like literally resources. And I know that that becomes even more so true if you're getting into certain other smaller dialects, or I would say topolects in China, that, you know, there may not be really no resources for native English speakers or whatever your language is, that you're going to have to actually learn Mandarin first at times if you really want to get into studying and learning that that specific language.
So on the topic of learning Cantonese and resources for learning Cantonese, I know that some of you out there have learned Cantonese or are working on it, and we would really love to hear from you so that we can share some of these resources. We don't want to pretend like we have this knowledge that we don't have. So maybe you could even be a guest on the show. We'd really like to hear from you so that we can share this information, because I know other Chinese learners are interested too, not just Patrick.
All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion.
That's right. And today we're talking about our breakthrough level graded reader called Just Friends.
Yeah, so Just Friends is breakthrough level, which means it's only 150 unique characters. And it is an amazing love story of sorts, told in a very simple, innocent way.
Love triangle-ish.
Yeah,
a story. But it is a great story. I love this story. I guess I took lead on this one, right? It's a pretty fun story. Two guys like the same girl. They decide not to go after her, but then they kind of break the truce, and then you get all sorts of fun hijinks that ensue.
Yeah, so these are college kids. Some of our other stories have younger characters or whatever, but this is our college crowd story here for the breakthrough level learners.
So that's called Just Friends. It's our Mandarin Companion breakthrough graded reader using only 150 basic characters. You can find it on Amazon, iBooks, Kobo, or wherever you get your books. Check it out. All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
So I have a rave. This is related to today's topic, actually. When you're talking about dialects and, some of these specific details about Chinese, Wikipedia is a great resource. But it's also an interesting example because Wikipedia has different languages. And one of the, quote-unquote languages, we'll call it Tapalect or Fangyan or whatever, that it supports is the Wu Fangyan of the Shanghai region. Southern China. So you can actually read Wikipedia articles, not in Mandarin, but in this Wu Fangyan, which is actually pretty cool. And I don't know, it's kind of surprising that you'd find something like that on Wikipedia, but it is there.
So John, just to be clear, these articles are actually written using simplified Chinese characters, but it's maybe arranged a little differently or grammar's a little different. Explain that a little bit.
So things are different. Yes, it is Chinese characters. It's not romanization. And some characters you might not recognize, or they might be used in ways you don't expect. It's kind of trippy. We can give you a link if you want to check it out. Cantonese is a lot cooler when it comes to using characters because they have a lot of their own. But Wu is rocking it as well.
All right, man. I can't wait to be even more confused when I read something in Chinese.
It is awesome. You love it. We're all masochists here learning Chinese. All right, Jared, what do you got? Rant or rave?
All right, John. I guess I'll have a rant, okay? Because it'll turn into a rant in the end. But I think this is very interesting. I ran across an article based on some research by some linguists. So here's what they did. They took three people saying something in German. All right. And had one person there's two different German accents. There's kind of more a standard and then one that is a different area of Germany, an accent from there. And one was speaking German with a Korean accent. And they had people like native German speakers listen to it. But they showed different pictures of the people who are supposed to be saying what they're hearing. Now, it was really interesting because here's what they found. So when the accent matched the picture that they were expecting, they were able to understand it a little better. So, for example, they saw what someone they perceive as a German person, and it was kind of more of that standard German accent, they're like, oh, I could understand it. If it was German speaking with a Korean accent and they saw an Asian face, they could actually understand it a little better, as opposed if it was a Korean accent with a German, normal German person's face, if you will. But I think the takeaway from this is what, and they say this, is that by and large, but any time an Asian person's face was shown, whether or not it was an actual standard German accent or a German accent, like a Korean accent speaking German, they had a harder time understanding it. And this fell in line with a lot of other studies. And this reminded me, John, of like something that, you know, we say in that common saying of like, don't judge a book by its cover, right? And sometimes, you know, we see someone who doesn't look like us and they speak our language and maybe they have an accent, and sometimes, you know, we kind of judge that, right? We say, oh, I can't understand you or whatever. But really, I think what's interesting about this is that there's a lot of bias sometimes on that. When we look at someone and they don't pronounce it the way that we expect or whatever. But the research also showed is that when people who were really focusing on what was being said, that they actually ended up understanding everything that was said regardless of the accent. So the study was done in Germany, and it was done with a lot of different ages of language speakers. But I think for me, it was a little bit out of that reminder, right? That sometimes we are that person, right? Speaking Chinese, and we have that accent. And sometimes that Chinese person, because you know, for me, I've got a white face, you do too, John. And you know, they may be automatically biased, like, oh, I'm not going to be able to understand this guy. Yeah, on the other side is too. Sometimes people to me might be speaking English, and they may not look white, or maybe look what I expect to be a native English speaker. But just because of that, and they have an accent, doesn't mean I can't understand them. So I think this is something that, you know, I've become much more acutely aware of because, you know, we lived in another country. I've dealt with those struggles of learning a language and trying to speak it and be understood. And I think it's just a reminder to me that, hey, you know, we can all do a little better in this in making sure that we're trying to, you know, give people the benefit of the doubt and also just, you know, encourage people regardless of wherever they are on their language learning journey.
Yeah, and I think the brain is just an incredibly plastic thing. So it gets used to one thing, seeing people that look a certain way, talk a certain way. But then it can just as easily get used to the diversity that has become the norm today. And we just have to give it a chance, right? Stop being racist and you can learn Chinese.
And Shanghainese. And Spanish. And Japanese. Yeah, you polyglot you. People like you make me sick.
I'm Daniel Pang. I'm from Toronto, Canada.
Dan is the son of Chinese immigrant parents who moved to Toronto, Canada, and spoke Cantonese at home. But what he did next might surprise you.
And I quit my job as a doctor to study Mandarin Chinese in Taiwan.
You're going to want to hear this. Stay with us. Why did you start learning Chinese?
It stems from two main reasons. The first one being CBC, Canadian Born Chinese. So I grew up speaking a little bit of Cantonese. So that was my mother tongue.
Real quick on that, your parents, tell me a little bit about them.
Neither of them grew up speaking Cantonese. So my dad was born in Guangdong province in mainland China. He grew up speaking Kejiahua or Hakka. Mm. And my mom actually grew up in Vietnam, but she's also Chinese heritage. So she grew up speaking Chaozhihua, which is on the east side of Guangdong. My dad actually moved to Hong Kong when he was 20, and that's when he started learning Cantonese.
Oh.
And then my mom, I guess it was a diaspora of Cantonese speakers in Vietnam where my mom grew up, and that's where she kind of learned Cantonese, but it wasn't her first language. They met each other and their mutual language was Cantonese. So that's why they started speaking Cantonese to each other. But they never spoke to me in Mandarin. They always spoke to me in Cantonese. It was sort of basic stuff like, you know, what do you want for dinner? What do you want for lunch? Or, you know, hurry up, it's dinner time.
Did you also communicate with them in English as well?
No, it was all Cantonese. So there was definitely a bit of a language barrier there.
You know, that's really interesting. I can relate to the concept of having a language barrier. But having a language barrier with your parents, how do you think that impacted your relationship?
It's one of the main motivators to actually pursue learning Mandarin and Cantonese even too, because I wanted to improve that relationship with my parents because I felt a lot when I was growing up that I would get angry or frustrated because I wasn't able to express myself fully because of that language barrier, because there wasn't that full repertoire of, you know, words that I could use to express my emotions. And also, I don't know, you've probably heard this too, where in a lot of Asian families, we don't really talk about our emotions. So it was definitely accurate in my family, we didn't really express our emotions. So there was a lot left unsaid. And so that was, yeah, that was a real motivation for me to really want to learn their language, their heritage, and build a better relationship.
So you're growing up here, you're speaking Cantonese, but hey, you know, I'm not going to go out and learn Cantonese, I'm going to learn Mandarin. What's going on here?
I didn't have a lot of that interest early on. So I think you've also interviewed some ABCs where they've done some sort of Saturday school or Chinese classes on the weekends. And I certainly did that. I did that for, I think, a year. And I was so fed up with it. I didn't like it at all. And I was screaming and telling my parents, like, I didn't want to go back. So after a year, I stopped going. And it's so interesting how, you know, now this is the most important thing to me. This is like my passion to really learn Mandarin.
This is quite interesting, you know. In fact, it's a really common experience, you know. Weekend classes, all the kids hate it. But I'm curious to know what took place in your life because you went to med school. Now, number one, you got in. Great. Kudos right there, okay? You finished med school. You finished residency. You're a doctor. At this stage, you're every Asian parent's fantasy, you know. Then you're going to be like, I'm just going to leave all this behind. I'm going to go study Mandarin. What led up to that decision?
I think at the base of it, it really comes from the fact that medicine, it's really fun. It's really a fulfilling job. But for me, it wasn't the center of my world like it is for a lot of my colleagues. And I respect that. But for me, there was always that yearning or that urge to do other things. So one of those things that I really wanted to do was learn languages, especially Cantonese and Mandarin. And I think one of the things that really spawned that was the travel I did during my 20s. So I was lucky enough to do a lot of traveling, backpacking, being exposed to different cultures and different languages. And every time I would visit a country like Myanmar or Vietnam or Thailand and hear the local language or meet different travelers and backpackers and hear them speak their languages, I was always fascinated, especially with a lot of Europeans who speak multiple languages. And, you know, I want to learn this language. But then the inspiration or the motivation always sort of tapers out when I return back to Canada. And so for me, Cantonese and Mandarin was still something that I really wanted to learn because of that background. And I guess to put it simply, I guess Cantonese, I didn't pursue it as much because I decided to choose Mandarin just because they were a little bit related. And also, I felt that if I learned Mandarin, I could also improve my Cantonese because they were a little bit similar. But also, partly, I just wanted to chase an adventure and go to Taiwan, which I've never been to, and learn Mandarin.
So, what did you do?
After I graduated residency, I was 30, and I'd worked for about a year, saving up some money, paying off some loans. You know, those medical loans can be expensive.
Yep.
And then I remember saving up $10,000. It wasn't a lot at all, but I did some research into places I could study Mandarin. And so when I had saved up enough money, I felt confident in that I could live in Taiwan without working for maybe 4 to 6 months. That was what I was originally planning. I quit my job and I bought a ticket to Taiwan, and the rest is history.
So then what did you do? You booked a one-way ticket, going to Taiwan. I'm all in, right? I'm going to learn this language. So tell me about what you did.
Right. So I was only planning on staying for 4 to 6 months here. With that mindset, I really wanted to have an immersive experience. I had studied a bit in Canada for about a year on and off by myself, you know, listening to like Pimsleur tapes and a little bit of Chinese podcasts and doing some YouTube videos. But I always felt like I was never gaining any traction. I always felt like I was losing motivation. I didn't have that immersive experience. So I knew that, you know, I wanted to push myself. I wanted to throw myself into the deep end and travel to Taiwan. So my plan was, when I got there, I was really going to try to do as much as I could in these 4 to 6 months to try to improve my Chinese. So the first day I got there, I signed up for some Chinese classes. I posted on Facebook groups and looking for language exchange partners, and I would meet them almost every other day. The Chinese classes I did, maybe like an hour a day, maybe at first it was 4 hours per week, and then I switched to 5 hours per week, so an hour a day. I just wanted something motivating me every day. And then the thing that I think that really improved my Chinese was meeting some of the locals there. So because I was there alone, I didn't have any friends there. I think that allowed me to really push myself to make new friends, to meet the locals. So some of the closest friends I have here in Taiwan are just locals that run like the fruit stand on the corner under my building where I was living, or the Ayi, the lady who was selling, you know, fried rice under my building. And there was actually, there was one Ayi that I started talking and we developed this great relationship. I would go to her place every night after she finished work and we would talk from 10 p.m. to sometimes 2 a.m., 4 hours every day. And most of it was just her speaking to me and I was just listening, and I would probably at first understand, I don't know, maybe 20% of what she's saying, and I would have to like look up a lot of stuff. But eventually, as we started talking more and more, I would understand more and more. And I think doing that consistently was a huge, huge boost for my Chinese learning.
Wow. That's wonderful to hear that. Friends like that, people like that, they're just solid gold for learning a language, right? They're patient enough, they're consistent enough to have that conversation with you. So that sounds like it was really helpful for you. So what kind of progress do you feel like you made during that time? And where do you feel like your Chinese is now from where you started?
So like I said, I spoke a little bit of Cantonese. I think I was maybe overconfident about how much that would help me with my Mandarin, but I think it definitely helped me a little bit. So for example, if for those who don't know, there are grammar similarities between Cantonese and Mandarin, but a lot of the basic words that I knew are actually quite different. I think the similarities come more when you look at more formal Cantonese and more formal Mandarin, more the more upper, intermediate, and advanced words. But I think the more day-to-day stuff, there's actually a lot of differences. So a lot of the times that kind of tripped me up. And so when I first arrived in Taiwan, my level was probably upper beginner. And I would say through those 4 to 6 months where I was doing really intensive, heavy studying, I would study during the day, I would meet language exchanges, and I would, you know, for example, speak to the locals a lot. I think I was able to get to probably an upper intermediate level.
I'll say one of my takeaways from this, Dan, is that the research shows that you just need enough exposure to the language and the words until we start getting the feel for the language. And we talk about extensive reading. It's a great way to get that massive input if you're not in a local environment. But it sounds like you really put yourself out there and exposed yourself and got a lot of massive input.
Maybe it comes from me being in school for so long, but I just had an aversion to studying from textbooks and doing too much classroom time, even though I know there's definitely benefits to it. I was recently thinking about learning a different type of language like computer programming, and I came across this video where someone was asking, you know, how should I learn programming? And there was a video saying that, you know, you should really focus on what you want to do. You know, you shouldn't focus too much on how to actually learn a language, but what do you want to do with the language, you know, and then work backwards from there. So you're going to learn in the process of doing what you want to do.
That's a great insight. Well, I also want to know, Daniel, like, how has learning Mandarin, has it had any impact on your relationship with your parents?
That's an interesting question. I'm still in Taiwan, so I haven't gone back to Canada yet, but we've definitely kept up on the communication. We still speak over the phone. One interesting thing I've noticed is that as I'm improving my Mandarin and I'm speaking to them, so sometimes I'll try to speak to them in Mandarin as well, and sometimes in Cantonese, but as I'm improving, I've noticed that I'm using more complex words or more advanced words. And what I'll notice is that they'll actually pick it up, they'll understand it, and then they'll start being more expressive. They'll start using more advanced words too. And then I'll be so shocked and I'm like, whoa, I didn't know you knew that word. You know, how come you never used to say that word in the past when I was younger? And they're like, oh yeah, of course I know this word. and so I think learning the language and being able to communicate better, I feel, be more expressive and build that relationship with my parents more, I think.
I'd also like to know, Dan, from your perspective, how do you anticipate Chinese being part of your life going forward?
Interesting question, because during my time in Taiwan, I've kept up with medicine a little bit just because I want to keep up my skills. And so I've been doing a little bit of telemedicine, which is basically medicine over the phone. And interestingly, I have had a couple of patients who spoke mainly Cantonese or Mandarin. And so it was a great opportunity for me to really test it out.
Well, how did it go? I got to know.
So, I mean, it was definitely not smooth for sure, but I think I was really surprised by how well I was able to first understand a lot of what they were saying. And when I didn't, for example, it was mostly medical terms, for example, gallstone or things like that. And so I had to ask them about the more technical medical terms. I guess the more difficult part was me sort of expressing myself and not sounding like a kid who doesn't know what they're talking about.
You got to sound like a doctor,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So I think I prefaced it in front saying that, you know, my Mandarin is not that great, but I can try. That allows them to be a little bit more understanding. So at the end of it, you know, we did finish the consult. I did finish and I was able to help them, but there's definitely a lot of room for improvement. It was definitely not smooth, but I think I was very motivated, inspired, and impressed by my ability to understand them. That's definitely inspiring me to want to learn more so that, you know, when I do go back to Canada, there's a lot of Chinese speakers there. And so I think there is a need for Chinese speakers that can help with those native Chinese speakers that may not be able to fully speak English. And so hopefully I'll be able to do that.
And so, Dan, I also know that you have a YouTube channel to help other people learn Chinese. So tell me a little bit about that and why you started doing that.
Initially, that channel was just me uploading me speaking Chinese. And so I was trying to do a challenge where I wanted to practice speaking Chinese. And so I would pick a Chengyu every day and I would try to speak around it. So I just like make up some random dialogue or monologue on a Chengyu and I would just practice my speaking. And I just posted it on YouTube because I thought it would give me that extra pressure or extra motivation to speak better and to really enunciate my pronunciation. And so since that time, I've made some educational like videos where I was more sharing my experiences learning Chinese, but also I think you've seen one of more the skits where I was sort of making fun of myself and the many frustrations I've had learning Chinese.
Yeah, I think I saw that video you made about trying to order coffee, something I can relate with, you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so that video I posted on Reddit and a lot of people seemed to like it, but it was basically me trying to order coffee in Chinese and just the many frustrations of not being able to understand what the teller was saying, whether it's because they spoke too quickly or, you know, there was all this fanciful language around, you know, the different products. Think about like, you know, going to Starbucks, like the grande and the tall and like
those things are like, I have no idea what this guy's saying.
So, that was a constant frustration for me.
Well, Dan, I'm also curious to know about like the importance of literacy to you and how that's impacted your Chinese.
I think literacy is huge. So when I first started learning Chinese, I didn't spend that much time reading or trying to recognize characters. I did spend a lot of time, like a lot of people do, trying to copy characters down. And I think if I had to do it again, I probably wouldn't spend that much time just because it took a lot of time and it wasn't very motivating for me at first. But I think if I started reading more and start focusing more on recognizing characters, that would have been a lot more helpful. I didn't start that until I came to Taiwan when I was in the language school here and they made us read more. There were textbooks and there were short articles that we had to go through. And that was the first time I started really reading more. And actually one of the main goals that I had with Chinese, other than wanting to speak to my parents, was being able to order at a bubble tea shop or being able to order from a menu, a Chinese menu. And that was because when I went to China for the first time visiting family, I think I was around 18 at the time, and seeing everyone speaking Mandarin perfectly, seeing my family order from, you know, Chinese restaurant or order bubble tea, I was so fascinated. I was like, man, I want to be able to do this. But just looking at the menu, it just felt so daunting. There was only all these...
look like spooky animals are going to jump out at you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's something that I really tried to work on from day one. I still have a lot of menus that I stole from restaurants. Not stole, I guess. I just kept them and I would practice sometimes, like trying to understand, you know, the different items on the menu. So I think literacy is definitely very important.
So what's next for you, Dan?
So eventually I am going to have to go back to Canada and work for a bit and save up some more money. But I think in the meantime, I still have an opportunity to continue my Mandarin Chinese by continuing to read Chinese and continuing to listen a lot to podcasts. So podcasts have been something that have really helped just for giving me massive audio input. I'm able to stop if I need to. I'm able to slow it down. I'm able to speed it up even these days if I need to. And I'm also able to repeat, which goes into that spaced repetition function of things. And so I really love listening to podcasts. And then I guess other than Mandarin Chinese, I really want to try to apply what I've learned with Mandarin Chinese to improving my Cantonese. And I think reaching a upper intermediate level with Mandarin, I think there's a lot of translation over to Cantonese. And so I'm excited to start doing that. The other thing I didn't mention, I guess, is going back to Canada, I'm going to be working again as a doctor, I guess, more full-time. And I'm excited to use the Mandarin that I've learned. Like I mentioned before, if there's any patients that speak mainly Mandarin or Cantonese, I can really use these opportunities to practice and to keep my skills up.
That's wonderful.
Actually, I didn't mention this, but I was planning on coming to Taiwan for 4 to 6 months because I was planning a trip with my dad to visit my family in mainland China.
And oh, really?
Yeah. And at that time, I hadn't told them that I was studying Chinese. So I was planning to actually surprise them. But that eventually didn't happen because of COVID. But hopefully that opportunity comes up in the future. And that was actually a big motivating force for me to try to improve my Mandarin in such a short amount of time. And so hopefully I'll get that opportunity.
Daniel, if people want to find out more about you, where can they go?
They can find me on YouTube at Dan Yeo, that's D-A-N space Y-O, and you can find all the links there in my videos.
Well, Daniel, thanks so much for sharing your story, your experience with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast, Jared. I am a big fan of your graded readers as well, and looking forward to new ones.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, mother, architect, warrior, diver, skier, athlete, baker, barista, and that one gal named Margaret. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannercompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo at SubChina, and our interview editor is James Harper with Filter Productions. I'd like to thank our guest, Daniel Peng, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pasden. See you next time.